From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I finally decided to open my eyes and look, and when I did, I was shocked beyond belief. And so embarrassed that I hadn't looked earlier.
When publicists for Oscar-winning director Paul Haggis approached us about an interview to discuss his new movie, we said sure, but will he talk Scientology? Today we discuss the Crash director's new film, Third Person, and his split from the church after 35 years. But first on the News Banter, does Netflix have a late night? And why your cable box is costing you more than you think? Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my fellow banterer, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi, how are you?
I am good. So let's talk about Chelsea Handler. Now, you know, you're my colleague at The Hollywood Reporter. We broke that story about Chelsea Handler saying she was ditching E, and then there was a long sort of a subtle war of words between E and Chelsea Handler, she alleging that the E ratings were terrible and not giving her a good venue, and they suggesting that her ratings weren't so great either. And let's just say that deal was done after several seasons of her late night show there, and now she's doing something completely different.
Yeah, her show on Netflix is not expected to premiere until 2016, but it really is the next wave, it seems, in late night TV moving to digital services. And it'll be very interesting to see what a quote-unquote late-night talk show looks like on a digital streaming service.
Yeah, I mean, do they post it at night? What is the format? Is it different? Is it similar? I mean, it seems to me like every time there's another host, somehow the show basically seems kind of similar. You know, there's a guy at a desk talking and somebody on a couch talking back. But will Chelsea Handler compete with a very crowded space, you know, of conventional late-night Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy Kimmel, Stephen Colbert coming in, David Letterman leaving, and then there's the cable players, you know, Conan and Jon Stewart, and, you know, and it will be Larry Wilmore soon. Will she be fighting for guests, you know, when there's going to be a new movie coming out? Is she going to be chasing after Brad Pitt with the rest of them or trying a different thing?
Well, I think the fact that she is a woman will help her. I mean, her audience is mostly female, and that's an audience that is underserved by these all-male late-night TV shows, and it is all-male except for Chelsea Handler. I also think that, you know, she has shown herself on E! Able to get those kind of, you know, major show-style guests. She's has Jennifer Aniston on all the time, even being on a network like E! So I think it's probably going to be a nice transition for her to Netflix.
I mean, there is the argument to be made that she wouldn't fit in so well a lot of other places because she is a very particular type of taste. She's not somebody that anybody could see outside of late-night space. Now, again, on Netflix, there's no per se late night space unless they decide that they're going to tell us we're posting this every night at 11 o'clock or 11:15 or 11:21, and that's when you'll get to tap into it. But she is a particular taste. There was not an obvious thing for her to be on a broadcast channel or in an afternoon talk show, and this seems like a thing that might work for her. She's going to start with you know, a stand-up special and start to be a presence on Netflix with that, and then she's going to do what they're calling docu-comedy specials where she's going to do sort of adventures and be funny with doing them. And then finally in 2016, we'll see what this new show will be.
Yeah, you mentioned the kind of niche audience she has, and I think that that's a very key point for Netflix because they have proven very successful in targeting these particular niches. You know, they did House of Cards for that, you know, elite Emmy-style audience. They did Hemlock Grove for horror fans. They did Arrested Development because that's a very cult comedy that has a huge particular following. And I think Chelsea Handler falls right behind those in terms of a very engaged audience of fans that would follow her to this service.
Yeah, that's the hope, of course. And as we've recently found out, Netflix does not disclose a lot of numbers, and they live in a different universe from other people in cable and broadcast who are accountable for what their ratings are. They don't tell you much, but they have said that Orange is the New Black is their biggest show, and therefore the female audience is important to them.
Yeah, and I think that that's exactly what they're betting on here. They're saying, okay, we have a particular audience that is very engaged, and the numbers that they have apparently show this, and that Chelsea Handler brings that and is a nice counter to that. The question right now is, what does this show look like? Because the traditional late-night viewing pattern is not the same as it once was. If you miss something on late-night TV, you can watch it the next day on a viral video. So how, as a service, do you take advantage of that?
Yeah.
And maybe you create a show that lives 24 hours a day and then is replaced by the next one or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know whether they can get clips on YouTube or they want to. They don't have a lot of promotional platforms the way, you know, some of these other guys do on big networks where they're going to run ads in the middle of a football game. So it's going to be a different thing, and we'll see how it works out for them.
But you know what? They have 30 million subscribers plus, and the first thing that you could see when you turn on that Netflix may be Chelsea Handler. And if that's the case, then people will check it out.
And they do have a lot more granular information than anybody else in the game of entertainment, really. They know exactly what people are watching, when they're watching it, how long they're watching it for. And everybody else is sort of stuck complaining about the Nielsens and how unreliable those are. Speaking of Netflix and House of Cards, you mentioned, I noticed this week that the Chinese are using House of Cards. It's quite popular in China among certain people, apparently. And the Communist Party, its top corruption investigation group, has published an article saying that House of Cards is proof of how corrupt Western politics is and riven with ambition and corruption. You know, so China, I guess they're like, look over there, because they certainly have had some problems of their own.
Yeah, well, as with everything with China, that seems to be a double standard, though, because the same article noticed that sales of rowing machines are through the roof in China based on House of Cards. So it has become kind of a, use it as a target, but also emulate show.
Yeah, so maybe, yes, ambition is good, maybe. Turning to another international piece of news, the World Cup. Well, here at home, I will say, the World Cup has turned out to be unusually popular so far, and we don't know yet as it continues to go on, but there have been some records set in terms of viewership.
Yeah, I mean, the first USA match, if you tallied up English language, Spanish language streams, it's almost 20 million viewers that checked out that first US game. That is by far the biggest soccer audience in the US.
Well, actually, if you compare it to the Stanley Cup Finals, which were quite recent, that was 6 million viewers. So it definitely trounced that audience. On the other hand, it's not exactly doing, you know, big Super Bowl numbers.
No, I mean, soccer is certainly not where American football is. But I think the signs here are pointing towards growth. And as we know, in the TV business, that's what you want. I mean, Fox and Telemundo and some Spanish language radio stations, they paid about $1.2 billion for the next two World Cups, 2018 and 2022. And I think they're smiling right now because they're seeing the trajectory and they're seeing that this sport is catching on. And I think those investments may prove to be wise ones.
And it's also something here in this country as the Hispanic audience grows, right? Because that is an audience that is soccer fans. And I'll admit right now that I have no nothing about soccer, really, except that you're supposed to kick the ball into the net.
I think there are a lot of fans who are once every 4 years World Cup fans when the games come on, but it is being driven by this Latino audience that is growing in the U.S. and exerting more power. You see it in all aspects of the media, from, you know, opening weekend box office on movies that target Latinos, to, you know, ABC doing a news channel with Univision, to all the different ways that traditional media are trying to capture this growing Latino audience. When you look at the television landscape, the highest paid performer on television right now is Sofia Vergara from Modern Family, who makes most of her money from endorsements because she's a very high-profile Latino star.
Yes, nice work if you can get it. Now, I will just say, as we go out, that I saw an article in the LA Times this week that really captured my attention, which is that your cable TV box, Matt, is costing you more than you know, because it turns out that cable TV boxes are huge power hogs, and they run at almost full strength 24/7, whether you're, you know, looking at something on television or recording something or not.
Yeah, the key there is that it's actually using energy when it's dormant at night. So as you're sleeping in your home and you think your TV is off and not using any energy, that cable box is sucking energy.
They're saying this is as much as 4 giant nuclear reactors running around the clock, and there is pressure on the cable companies. There are environmental groups who think that they can do the cable companies can do better and be more power efficient. And you know, if they are and they figure that out, I'm going to guess it's not going to save you or me a dime.
No, although this is yet another reason to vilify your cable company.
Absolutely. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. Coming up, writer and director Paul Haggis explains how to shoot a movie set in several iconic cities when you don't have the money to go very far. Paul Haggis is the only filmmaker ever to write two movies that won back-to-back Best Picture Oscars. The first was the 2004 film Million Dollar Baby, directed by Clint Eastwood. And then there was Crash, which Haggis wrote and directed. That film won perhaps the most controversial Best Picture victory in recent history. And Haggis has been through years of litigation over profits from the project. With that struggle still underway, in 2009, Haggis made news of a different kind when he denounced the Church of Scientology in a letter that became public. He was moved to act when the church's San Diego affiliate took a position against gay marriage. The church had become a place where gay bashing was at least tolerated, he wrote, and he criticized other policies as well. A Scientology spokesman responded that the church supports civil rights. Today, we talk with Haggis about the Crash controversy, his split from Scientology, and his new film, Third Person. Haggis wrote and directed the drama about three couples in three different countries who may not know each other, but who are all connected by tragedy. The film's considerable cast includes Maria Bello, Mila Kunis, Kim Basinger, Adrian Brody, and James Franco. Liam Neeson stars as a married writer living in Paris who finds an on-again, off-again lover in another ambitious writer played by Olivia Wilde.
You should be writing about me. Are you?
I write about what I know.
And you know me.
And I fictionalize what I can't comprehend.
It's a lot of fiction. So it's not about me. You know, if I don't find a use for you soon, I'm going to have to get rid of you.
You've been saying that for the last 2 years. Isn't going to happen.
Really? Watch me.
Despite his long experience, Haggis says he struggled to write this complex, layered story.
I got it wrong so many times. And then
it just felt wrong.
No, I knew it was wrong. I'd read it and go, oh, this is bad. And then I'd throw it out and start over. So it took me like 2.5 years to get a screenplay that I liked. And then it took a while to get the right financing. And then to
How did you do that?
We ended up going to a financier in Belgium who I'd met at the Berlin Film Festival. We're putting together. We had one big misstep with a guy who said, oh, yes, we took it to Cannes, and it was a German financier who will remain nameless who said, yes, got it covered. Whole budget, done deal. And it took about 6 or 8 months to negotiate the deal with it forever.
Ow,
and
this is a bad ending.
Only about 8 months later, we found he didn't have any money at all.
Oh, my God. Was he just a weird guy who was swanning around?
He had good intentions. And then finally remembered this man that I'd met in Berlin, and I called him.
Another man.
The Belgian financier, right. Corson, Paul Bruhls. And he said, yes. I sent him the script. He'd read it. He loved it. I said, I have Liam and Olivia, and I don't know who I'm going to cast in the rest. And he said, great, let's go it. Let's do it. So
how much were you looking for, roughly?
About $20 million.
Yeah, so you have Liam, Olivia, and then you get your $20 million, and you take it out to this other...
Yeah.
I mean,
then you start fighting. It was largely, everybody did it for love. There was no money involved in this one. Everyone stepped up for way below their quotes. I mean, way below their quotes to do it. And, but you're shooting, a movie that ostensibly takes place in three different countries is expensive. So we landed on Italy because... Yeah, the other two, New York and Paris. There were a lot of interiors, a lot of hotel rooms and things I could build.
Right.
But I couldn't fake Rome. Really? Now mm-hmm. Rome and Puglia in the south, and so we landed there, and then started to figure out how to make it there, and we did. We worked out with Cinecittà, the studio
in Italy.
Fabulous studio there. We built a very small. back. It took a very small New York street and made one on the
shot
on
Gangs of New York. Yeah.
Yes, he did, and it said still there, but isn't quite, you know, usable.
Not usable for your purposes. Yeah,
no, and so we faced one wall, a few shops, and then got really inventive about how to shoot on that for New York. And then I have a brilliant.
Well, like, tell me one you're proud of.
Well, I mean, we shot a lot of inside out, you know, so we'd be inside the store looking out, so we'd see the streets. Mm. And people would enter, and we'd shoot Paris or New York, you know, someone getting out of a cab and running in there, and then boom, we'd be inside, and it sells. Same with the drugstores in New York and the various things we shot there. Then we went home.
So wait a minute, just by doing that, you're shooting inside the looking out. I mean,
and we brought in taxi cabs from Bulgaria.
So you're faking the exterior.
Yeah, faking the exterior, and the only place we could get yellow cabs in Europe was Bulgaria. So we brought in six of those. And we just kept recycling those over and over again. And and then got to shoot a little bit in New York and a little bit in Paris, too.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with filmmaker Paul Haggis, whose latest movie is Third Person. Nearly 10 years ago, Haggis wrote and directed Crash, another story involving interconnected relationships with a big cast, including Dennis Hopper, Sandra Bullock, and Don Cheadle.
It's the sense of touch. Any real city, you walk, you know? You brush past people, people bump into you. In L.A., nobody touches you. We're always behind this metal and glass.
When Crash won the Academy Award for Best Picture, not everyone felt the right film had prevailed. That year, the contenders included Brokeback Mountain, Munich, Capote, and Good Night and Good Luck. Not only does the choice remain controversial, but for years there was litigation over profits from the film. Haggis and some other key players only prevailed this past February. Crash obviously, you know, won Best Picture, but for some reason that is the mother of all Oscar controversies. I don't even know if it's that way to you, but to me, looking around, you know, some people may not think that Argo deserved a Best Picture, whatever, but for some reason Crash is the one where you get comments on the internet and back and forth. Mm-hmm. And how is that for you? And why do you think that is?
Well, it's this is going to sound awful. I don't make movies for other people.
Okay. Hear that, people?
No. I'm a hard enough audience to please myself. And it's a tough thing to do, just to find a story that intrigues you and to tell it well. And I do it well sometimes, and I don't do it well other times. But it's a constant struggle. Then if it gets awards attention or something, that's lovely. But I never thought for a second we'd get nominated with Crash and win. I kind of think that anyone's going to come up with any reason why they're going to support one film or not another. But I don't think that a shoo-in would be, you know, me calling a bunch of liberals in Los Angeles racist. I don't think it's something they'd think, oh, yeah, that's what we are.
Yeah.
You know, we should vote for
portrayal.
That film.
Yeah. Okay. So then the litigation started, and you within a few weeks, maybe a few months ago, a couple months ago, did some of this litigation, is it finally resolved? There was all sorts of litigation with you and, I guess, Bob Yaring.
Resolved. We won because he, you know, I mean, sadly, read what happened there. I don't need to rehash that. But yeah, we won the lawsuit, and now we just have to collect the money, which is a whole different thing.
So, I mean, I almost wonder, what do you make of it looking back? You know, you made this movie, you made it for yourself, and it won the Oscar, and then years of litigation. Would you say to somebody, this was worth it? Or
of course, it made my career. I mean, that and Million Dollar Baby.
Right. So all the hassle of Crash and controversy is still worth it.
Wow, I got to make those two movies. I got to make Million Dollar Baby and Crash right back to back.
Coming up after a short break, Paul Haggis talks about his departure from the Church of Scientology and how he got into it in the first place. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Filmmaker Paul Haggis never intended to become the public voice of fallen away Scientologists in Hollywood. But that's what happened after his critical 2009 letter to the church went public. He complained about the church's stance on gay marriage and its policy of requiring church members to disconnect from friends and family who are not members. Haggis's repudiation of Scientology was explored in depth when author Lawrence Wright wrote a profile for The New Yorker in 2011. The church has accused Haggis of using his connection with Scientology to promote his films and called him delusional. So you left Scientology, you sent a letter, it's quite public, but you didn't do any interviews. And so has that...
Then Lawrence Wright, the bastard, tricked me.
Lawrence Wright wrote, of course,
the infamous New Yorker article.
Which became a book. And he's been a guest on the show as well.
A wonderful writer.
Right.
And it was very funny because my manager, Larry Bexy, called and said, the New Yorker wants to do a profile of you. And of course, my head got like four times as big in that second. What, really? The New Yorker? Me? Well, okay. Well, let me consider that. Yes. and so he came to my... editing room, well, like I said, while I was cutting the next 3 days. And he came in the morning, and got around 10 o'clock, we had coffee, we talked.
He's a pretty charming guy.
Very charming. And we talked about my early career, my work in Haiti, all these things. And it gets to around 4 o'clock, and I go downstairs for a cigarette, and he comes with me, and he goes, so... Scientology. I went, oh, damn, that's what this is about.
That's what this is about.
I'm so blind. Yeah. He goes, yeah. I said, okay, well, I figured, all right.
He did a little seduction first, right?
Yeah, and he said, well, you know what? I thought at that point, well, I didn't really want to become the anti-Scientology guy. So, all right, well, I'll answer a few questions. He'll go away because interviews like this one, where they last an hour at the most. And he'd already been there for 4 or 5 hours. So another half hour, he'd leave. He'd get what he wanted. So I answered a few questions and... Then he said, great, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, I'm editing again. Why? He said, well, I thought I'd drop over for lunch. I said, how long are you going to spend on this? He said, I don't know, 9, 10 months. I'm going to interview everyone you've ever met. And I went, oh, my God, I'm in so much trouble. At that point, I had to make a decision. And I went, well, if I'm ever going to tell this story, Larry Wright, I mean, he's a hell of a writer.
Right.
And, so I was a huge admirer of his. And I thought, well, he'd probably get it right. And so I said, yeah.
After he left Scientology, Haggis lost a lot of friends who remained in the church. None of this was what he had imagined 35 years earlier when he joined Scientology, imagining that he was aligning himself with a scrappy outsider organization.
I mean, I have a thing about, underdogs. I have this thing.
Right.
And I hate bullies. The only fights I've had in my life are with people much larger than me. And usually they're picking on someone much smaller than me, and a woman or some subordinate or whatever. And that's the only reason I get into the fight, and I usually get my ass kicked every time.
Right.
So in this case, I viewed Scientology
as the underdog.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think all these bigots, people who are out there who's saying right. things. So I didn't read the Time magazine article, or the Rolling Stone, or any of those things right. as a point of pride. But slowly things started to seep in that I felt, oh, I don't like that, and I don't like that. And so I tried to work from within and say, listen, guys, this is not right. You should change this. And then got incredibly frustrated and finally decided to open my eyes and look. And when I did, I was shocked beyond belief and so embarrassed that I hadn't looked earlier.
I know quite a few people who have come out of Scientology with similar feelings. Do you feel like it's hindered, helped, or not affected your career?
Well, I got in when I was 21 in Canada because I was in love. And it was two hippies above a Five and Dime store, chain smoking. And they said, what's ruining your life? And I said, my relationship. I'm in love with this woman, and I don't know what to do. And they said, we can help you with that. And I said, thank God, I need the help. And that's why I got in. So I think it probably helped my relationship at that point. There was some really good self-help stuff in the beginning. And that's what I wanted, because I'm an atheist. I've always been an atheist. And so I'm not a believer, but one of the very first things they say is don't believe any of this. If it works for you, use it. If it doesn't, discard it. That's my kind of thing, place. And if they needed to call it a religion, fine. But that changes slowly. I always support it. I slowly stopped being that involved, but I always vocally support it. I remember even when I had real qualms about it, This is me. This is my friends, and this is when I have serious qualms. So you know, that was the hardest thing for me to walk away from my friends because I knew they were all going to walk away from me.
And they did.
Yes, of course.
So the career impact or none?
Well, I don't get to work with some people I really liked working with, and other than that, how the hell do you know? You know, I mean, I'm living in New York now, so and they don't have that large of a footprint there. I'm an independent filmmaker.
I've been interviewed about Scientology myself, and people always say, why is Hollywood susceptible to Scientology? And I think it's partly the obvious reason that because they're not making widgets here, they're trying to do something that isn't formulaic or there's no recipe, and you're grasping for something to get. I mean, disagree with me if you think I'm wrong. You've been in and I haven't.
We're all looking for answers somewhere or other. And every loner wants to be part of a group. I was a loner, so I wanted to be part of a group.
Right, and it's a very tight-knit group.
Yeah.
Do you think that, do you have a sense that the influence of Scientology in Hollywood has grown? It's obviously it was a strategy of L. Ron Hubbard to pursue Hollywood celebrity.
I just haven't been paying that much attention to them since I left. And I
sort of thought you were the go-to guy to get out.
To get out what?
If you're an industry person who wants to get out of Scientology.
Well, no, I think people have come to me, and quietly, always quietly. And I'll talk to them. And try to give them my best advice, but I guess I'm not on some crusade. You know, if something worked for people, I don't care what they believe. But I do run into people who said, you know, I read your article. I got out because of what you did, and thank you, mostly. And you know, these are some well-known people, but a lot of people who are not well-known, people who are in the C organization, you know, sort of signed
that's
a billionaire.
That's kind of the clergy almost.
Yeah, they signed a billionaire contract to work for $50 a week
and
get paid that. And so some of those people, there are folks that I've met, but mostly I bump into them on the street by accident, and they'll just say thank you. For speaking out.
And I think your name came up in connection with Leah Remini, didn't it?
Yeah.
And you helped her. So yeah. is there another one coming?
She did.
Is there somebody you want to share with us that we should look for as our next interview, Paul?
No. I haven't heard of anybody else.
And so at this point, you're making your films. It's no longer a thing. And
I mean, they are really active on the internet, you know, trying to make people think less of me, whatever it is. They've got a couple of really funny websites that are talking about what a hypocrite I am and things like that. And they do. I mean, if you check with Wikipedia, they got busted there for anonymously going on Wikipedia and making comments and changes under a myriad of names, different names. And Wikipedia got smart enough to check the IP addresses, and they all came from the same IP address. And so they've got smarter than that now, but there are two people sitting in a basement in, you know, just not too far from here who, that say, spend their day going online posting things under false names. And they're not going to say, I'm a Scientologist, and therefore what this guy did is...
No,
they're
going to
say, you're going to say, you know, I agree, Crash is the worst movie of all time.
Paul Haggis is the Oscar-winning director of Crash. His new movie, Third Person, is now playing in New York and Los Angeles. And that's The Business. Nick White and Ray Guarna produced and edited today's program with assistance from Caitlin Parker and Will Bentley. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.